Last week on Sunday Extra, we discussed the life of Tom Bunning, one of the many people called Bunning behind the business that we now know as Bunnings. This week, we go from iconic hardware to iconic wine. Penfolds is a household name in the area of wine, not just in Australia, but around the world. And one of the main Penfolds behind the name and the wine business is Mary Penfold, described in a recent biography as a business genius and a great Australian winemaker. Julie McIntyre is Associate Professor in History at the University of Newcastle, and she's written a number of award-winning books about wine history. Julie also wrote the entry for Mary Penfold for People Australia, which is a National Centre of Biography website. Julie McIntyre, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Good morning, Julian.
So, Julie, who was Mary Penfold?
Mary Penfold is a woman born at a fascinating time, which is the end of the Napoleonic Wars for Britain, a period when in the burgeoning British Empire, Britain began to turn from fighting the French to thinking about building its empire. And a part of that process was the encouragement of the movement of people into the colonies. So the point at which Mary was born in 1816 was a time also when there's not formal education for women, but certainly there's a lot of thinking among middle-class women about the nature of their education. And I mention that because she had a very well-educated mother and her father was a doctor. So Mary was the only child of a couple who loved her deeply. There are these kind of beautiful quotes about how her mother thought of her in letters that exist. Mary then, in her late teens, she met the man that she would marry. And this then became part of what propelled her into that experience of becoming a colonist. And then the story of how she emerges as a winemaker is kind of related to what her class was and also what her circumstances were.
Yeah, so she was born Mary Holt, and then, as you say, she got married. That's where she got the name Penfold. And all that happened in England. So what do we know about when and why Mary Penfold and her husband, Christopher, came to Australia?
They married and moved to Brighton. When they were in Brighton in the 30s, they set up a medical practice and they were there for a couple of years. They had their daughter, Georgina, who was born in 1838. And then there's some cloudy detail about whether it was the case that Christopher borrowed some money from his brother. Now, he was one of 13 children, and apparently he had a brother of means who might have also been a little bit conditional about his purse strings. Christopher had borrowed money for he and Mary to set up a medical practice that would attract well-to-do clients in Brighton. But then somehow Christopher wasn't able to meet the interest payments. That could be related to why it was that Christopher became very enamored of immigration agents at this time. One of the things that's going on in London at this time is that the colonial agents of, for example, the colony of South Australia, have put together prospectuses to encourage colonial immigrants. In South Australia, particularly, the colonial project depends on encouraging free settlers. So Christopher Penfold, as the evidence tells us, really became convinced by the immigration agents. There's this wonderful quote in a letter from Mary's mother when she's written about Christopher that she says, quote, "Christopher would listen to no one but the immigration agents." And this is Mary's mother worrying about her daughter going to the other side of the world and really missing her. But it gives us a sense of how it was that Christopher fell in with this idea, and maybe that was able to assist him with dealing with moving away from his brother and this complexity of indebtedness. It could have been something else. But we do know that the immigration agents were certainly very persuasive for Christopher. And so they packed up the family and moved to South Australia. They arrived in Adelaide in 1844.
And Julie, you said that Christopher and Mary set up a medical practice. As I understand it, Christopher was a doctor, Mary wasn't. So what was the nature of her involvement in the medical practice?
We partly speculate because in some of these cases, there aren't records that tell us exactly, but she would have managed the patients coming to see him. So she also quite likely, knowing from some other evidence what a great bookkeeper she was, she would probably have kept the family accounts. So when I talk about the two of them setting up the practice, it's to be really careful not to erase the fact that her work was essential in terms of the economic labour to make that partnership work.
And when Christopher and Mary moved to Australia, it's reported that they brought with them a small collection of grapevine cuttings. What do we know about that and why would they have done it?
The vines they reportedly brought with them, I just love these stories because they can be a little bit mythological, but, you know, maybe they're based in fact. What the story is that Mary and Christopher brought some Grenache cuttings wrapped in canvas. You can probably imagine that when you look at a grapevine once the leaves have fallen at the end of the fruiting season and the pruning happens, vines are pruned to a particular kind of length. And then because it's best to create a vineyard from vines clonally rather than planting from seeds, because if you plant grapevines from seeds, nature has its way with evolution and you may not get what you bargained for. But if you plant vine cuttings from a parent plant, you're going to be imitating the qualities of that parent plant. So Mary and Christopher brought Grenache vines. It's really interesting to speculate about where they might have come from. There were certainly lots of plant nurseries in England. So it's not necessarily the case that they would have got them, say, directly from France. They could have quite easily bought them in England. The intention seems to have been very clear that they would try to grow what are definitely wine grapes too, because this is interesting to help us understand intention here, that there are different varieties of grapes that are specifically for table or specifically for drying. But Grenache seems to definitely be a wine grape for, in terms of their planning for what they might do. And it's good to keep in mind that this isn't something that happened in isolation. There is quite a great deal of enthusiasm among not just German immigrants who people are familiar with as instigators of the wine industry in South Australia, but also among British immigrants, thinking about the possibility of growing wine grapes, because it was very well known in Britain that if a vineyard could be created in particular colonial land that was suitable for planting it, then it would add value to the land. But it also is a more valuable crop, takes a lot longer to establish, and the infrastructure can be more complex. But ultimately, it's a very valuable crop.
Julie, I think to contemporary minds, the idea of being a doctor doesn't necessarily have any connection to being a maker of wines. But back in the days of the Penfolds that we're talking about, there was a bit more of a connection. Is that right?
One way of putting ourselves in that thinking is to reflect on the contemporary trend you might have noticed for a new sobriety, where people are moving, for example, to low or no alcohol wine. These kinds of trends come generationally at times. You would possibly be quite familiar with the idea of temperance movements, particularly prohibition in the United States, but also in the UK, in Britain, around this time and then increasingly into the 1860s, we see medical doctors thinking about the fact that if people are going to be drinking alcohol, then it's better for them to be drinking alcohol that's healthy. There's a long history too of wine being used as a tonic, as medicine. So on all of those maritime voyages that establish empire, the trade that occurred between wine-growing countries and countries that purchased wine. Wine was useful for preventing scurvy and in other ways for being a tonic, sort of thing we might titter about now. But before the pharmaceutical support for health that has developed across the 20th century, wine had this tonic contribution in the medical doctor's arsenal of ways of treating Actually, arsenal might be a word that some doctors might consider to be a strong one. But the notion of wine as medicine is something that Christopher Penfold seems to have had a really strong sense of. And knowing how closely he and Mary worked together, that sense of kind of a very moral way of treating people, but within the culture that exists, which is that there was quite a bit of alcohol consumed. You know, it's very much a part of daily life. And the idea then is it can be given as medicine, but also what the Penfolds want to do is produce wine. At first, mainly they're thinking about producing wine that they can recommend to patients of all sorts of classes. So it's a really complex history that gets a little bit forgotten when you think about the fact that, in fact, some of our most interesting historic books about the nature of wine come from doctors. So some in the late 19th century, and then in the late 20th century, we can see there were doctors actually publishing about wine too. So the idea of doctors either abstaining from wine, because quite often doctors of all genders love wine, there's also a sense of it being able to be something that can be healthful.
But it sounds like back in the day, patients might occasionally find themselves in the situation of Dr. Penfold recommending a Penfold's wine in the surgery. On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Julie McIntyre, who wrote the entry about Mary Penfold for the National Centre of Biography website People Australia. And Julie, you were very careful on the medical practice to preserve the role of Mary in the establishment of the practice. What about in the wine business? What do we know about how involved she was in the establishment of the vineyard and the growth of the wine business?
So Mary really was a farm manager, and the wine growing business emerges from that broader farm management. Eventually it becomes the main business of Penfolds. But at first, as the vineyard's being established, which takes quite a few years, and beyond that, few vines that were in a suitcase, possibly, you'd imagine you need hundreds, possibly thousands of vine cuttings to create a vineyard, and that can take many years. So as well as that burgeoning idea that we see on the farm, there are some lovely descriptions that help us understand what else was going on the farm that Mary was managing, and managing in terms of day-to-day life, and also we know she kept the books. For example, we think about a letter she wrote home where she talked about her daughter Georgina playing with the farm animals. So there were apparently turkeys and other poultry, and there were pigs. And I think we can safely picture a very healthy kitchen garden. And there was talk of some crops as well that were established at the farm, which was called McGill, when the Penfolds purchased it. So if you think about the fact that the Penfolds are making a living from both Christopher's medical practice, which was run out of the dining room at Grange Cottage, which already existed at McGill when the couple bought the property.
And where we get the name of Grange for the Penfolds wine.
Precisely. And also that then Mary is with her companion, Ellen Kimbrell, who's quite an important character as well in Mary's story. She's an employee, but she's a female companion, so there's clearly a deep attachment between the two of them, and Ellen is also involved. So if we picture what it was that Mary was doing in that partnership, what I see in my mind's eye is Christopher spending a lot of time in his surgery and probably also doing visits around the community. That's fairly certain. But then Mary being fundamentally at large, I'm not sure about the extent of her household staff beyond Ellen. And I think that's something that it would be really terrific to understand a little more, because the enterprise that she built does take more people. And that means also managing labor, managing the payment of people and so on. So it's very much the case that Mary is the financial manager of this partnership, and also that process of creating the wine business, which grows to be quite significant.
So to what extent was Mary's contribution and role in the wine business actually recognised at the time, Julie?
At the time, Mary's contribution was recognised in local newspapers. Anyone in Adelaide, anyone within her locality, understood that it was Mrs. Penfolds, which I think makes it fascinating when we reflect on the fact that later the emerging marketing stories about Penfolds wrote Mary out.
Mm.
There are certainly ways to understand that, which is that, for example, the shaping of Penfolds wine, particularly Penfolds Grange, as an iconic wine has a gendered element to it. So even though we can think back to the way that the story of Penfolds Grange as a wine that had this fascinating origin as something that was an experiment by the winemaker at Penfolds in the 1950s, Max Schubert, and the story that Max Schubert conducted an experiment about creating full-bodied red wine that could be cellared. That is such a skill to be able to grow grapes and manage them, harvest them at a particular time and manage that wine in a way that once you've got it in barrels and bottles, it's better 25, 30 or more years later. Being able to do that is an extraordinary skill, really fascinating. Also quite costly because, you know, you've got to keep the wine for that period of time. But then it's possible to add a lot of value to the wine for people who want to own it and drink it because that's where the notion of an icon comes from. So the story about Penfolds that we're largely more familiar with now comes from the company, in a very savvy way, telling a story about Penfolds that's to do with Max Schubert's innovation, which, you know, it's a little bit secretive. He goes ahead with doing his experiments about creating this very cellarable wine, even though the company tells him to stop. But telling that story also depends on the notion that the market for that wine is likely to be mainly, you know, powerful men who can afford it, who might not be so interested in a story about the wine having origins in a woman's story. To be fair, that creation of the consecratable Penfolds Grange that Max Schubert innovated is his story. But then the brand itself, we do need to understand that that came out of Mary's management.
Another thing about Mary Penfold was her longevity. Dr. Christopher died at the age of 59 in 1870. Mary lived for another quarter of a century to 1895. What happened to the wine business when Christopher died, and how long did Mary remain involved?
When Christopher died, Mary heard from Thomas, her son-in-law. He was the agent for the company in Melbourne up until when Christopher unexpectedly, and, you know, very young at 59, passed away. Thomas wrote to Mary and said something along the lines of, "Oh, look, you're going to need my help. Can you hold the fort?" I'm paraphrasing. "Can you hold the fort for 6 months and then I'll come and fix it and take over for you?" At which point Mary wrote back and included all of the financial documents and her sense of how the business was being managed and proposed that they form a partnership, which, quite humbled, Thomas accepted. And then Mary stayed working in the business still for some years. She reached about 68. So this is in 1884. She stayed at the Grange, and her granddaughter Inez, who was a poet, came to live with her. So she was able to see out her days in this lovely relationship between herself and Inez. Now, Inez died before Mary did, and she did this magnificent thing where she published Inez's poetry as a way of remembering her. And this was poetry that was received quite well within the colony, in fact. Towards the end of her life, Mary suffered from an illness that meant she became quite unwell. She went to live with Georgina after Inez died. She went to live with Georgina and Thomas in Melbourne, which is where she passed away. But then her remains were carried by train back to Adelaide. And so interesting to consider that it's the very train, it's the transportation system that, in order for her business to flourish, she had so actively campaigned for. On the train, she was taken back to Adelaide, and she's, in fact, buried in St. George's Church, Woodford McGill Cemetery, which is a church that her husband had been on the board of at first instigating.
Julie, what was Mary Penfold's reputation as a winemaker as opposed to the proprietor of a wine business?
She was considered a very astute blender of wines. The way that wines were made then was that is very much a dependence on the seasonal quality of grapes. And Penfold's wasn't just working with its own grapes. The company also brought in grapes from other growers in the district. So, that, you know, really quite a large enterprise. And the way that Mary would manage this in collaboration with Gillard after Kimbrel passed on was that she would have the wine made, and she had very up-to-date equipment and facilities. She would have the wine made and then keep some of it for a couple of years. So some would be sold young, but she would keep some of it for a couple of years and then blend it in a way that she became quite skilled at understanding how then that wine could go on to be able to be transported. So, you know, you can imagine transport's quite slow if you're exporting to New Zealand. For example, you need that wine to be quite stable for the travel. And also the quality of the wine from that blending is part of the way that the reputation for the wine develops. And it's a good moment to mention that she did enter some wine, as did lots and lots of colonial Australian wine growers. Some of the skill in blending that's really important is then building a reputation for the wine and then taking it to shows. Wine shows are really important in colonial Australia. And one of the things that colonial Australian wine growers do that's really important for them to get a sense of their wines in competition with the wines of the world is to enter some of the international exhibitions that are very frequent across the second half of the 19th century. And Penfold's wine was entered into some of those competitions and, in fact, won gold medals internationally. This speaks to Mary's skill as a wine blender.
Well, it's great to know that the history of Penfold's winning wine awards goes all the way back to Mary's time. And Julie, thank you so much for speaking with us about the role of Mary Penfold in Penfold's becoming a household name.
Thank you, Julian.
That's Dr. Julie McIntyre, Associate Professor of History at the University of Newcastle, and author of Mary Penfold's entry in People Australia, the National Centre for Biography's website.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.